history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there waiting to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, we end up learning a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Last weekend, we had Pearl Harbor Day, so the program focused on four amazing Pearl Harbor survivors. This week marks a significant anniversary as well. On Sunday, December 15th, they're gathering in Washington, D.C. for a candlelight vigil and the reading of more than 6,000 names, all Americans confirmed killed in action during the Battle of the Bulge. The next day, December 16th, marks the 75th anniversary of the start of that massive engagement. And that's when the official commemoration will take place at the National World War II Memorial. Over the years, we've heard from dozens of veterans who were involved in one way or another with the Battle of the Bulge. We've heard about intense combat, the unforgiving weather that left so many with frozen feet and fingers. We've heard from those wounded, those captured, and even from some who escaped their captors. And we're going to get a taste of all of those plot lines today. It's been estimated that nearly 20,000 Americans gave their lives in that six-week battle. Nearly 50,000 were wounded and nearly 25,000 captured. A good chunk of those who became prisoners did so at the very outset of the battle, when communications miscues caused more than 6,000 men of the 106th Infantry Division to, in effect, be hung out to dry. Men like Mac McMullen and the rest of his anti-tank platoon had been told they were headed to a quiet sector in the Ardennes Forest.
They put us up there to get some experience. As an example, for the gun they give us, we had five rounds of ammunition for that 57-millimeter gun. Our own personal, we had two clips on our belt for our rifle and one in the rifle. And that's all the ammunition we had. We couldn't beat a Boy Scout troop, you know. but it was supposed to be a quiet zone to let us get adapted to what we were doing and get a little bit of experience before we see the big fight.
So what was the first inkling you had that this was not a quiet zone and that you had company in this neighborhood?
Well, I'll tell you a little story along that line. The sergeant and I were up on out of the bunk. It was just getting dark.
Mm-hmm.
And with those trees, that with the forest, they were close together, straight pine trees and snow on the ground. And if somebody was walking, you could follow them because the snow would blank out where mm-hmm. they were walking. And we were up there, and all at once, we looked out, and we see some, maybe 50 yards away, something like that. And I don't know who fired first, whether my sergeant fired or they fired or what, but there was a little short exchange, and then it all quit. So Art couldn't have fired the first round because he didn't fire any. I did. And I said, well, why didn't you fire? And he was a married man with a couple of kids. And he says, I thought a guy might have a kids at home like I have.
Hmm.
The irony of this is that out of our group, the first guy to get killed was Art later on in the time. But he wouldn't shoot, and then he ends up being the one that gets killed.
He didn't want to deprive some kids of their father.
Yeah.
And his children were deprived of their father.
So the next morning, on the 16th, daybreak, all hell broke loose. That's when the shells start flying. Mm-hmm. And they just come and come and come. And they did for, 2 days while we stayed there 2 nights. We were there the 16th and 17th, and then the 18th. And then we got orders to move out on the 19th. And we got the truck and the cannon and started and fell in line. There was trucks as far as you could see in a line.
I can only imagine.
It was, by now it's slow. You stop and you sit there and this. Eventually we ended up on this long, narrow hillside road. if you fill that all full of trucks, it was like going to the carnival. These guys were down here with 88s that could hit that thing those up there without any trouble, and we couldn't move. By now, we were boxed in.
So you were sitting ducks with the German artillery aimed right at you.
Yeah. So that's when we got orders to surrender. We were captured late in the evening and marched down the hill. And they got a little town called Belief, B-E-L-I-E-F or something like that. Mm-hmm. They congregated us there, put us in column, and so many abreast, and started down there. Didn't stay abreast very long. It was just mass. At least see on the movies, you know, confusion.
And was there talk among your ranks of guys trying to go out on their own, make a break for it, avoid capture and captivity?
Not at that point. We weren't sure. We didn't know what we were doing. We were just surrounded. That's the night I got my feet wet. I got both feet wet, and I didn't have combat boots because they didn't have my size. So I got the regular shoe, and I tried to go through a little stream where you jump across. I got both feet wet and got them frozen. Mm-hmm. And later on, as things went on, because we walked that particular time, we walked from the middle of that afternoon, all that night, all the next day, and then before we stopped. And by the time we got there, my feet were frozen, and I was at the point where this is where I couldn't make it anymore. And this is when I went to church and Sunday school and all that, but I was one of these guys that prayed for a bicycle or something like that. And I was holding back, saving that, I guess. I didn't know it, but I prayed that just give me one more half mile. Just give me one more half mile. And then I got to where I was getting ready to drop out. And somebody I don't know, never saw him before. I've never seen him since. He was a big guy. He grabbed me by, put it on his shoulder or arm, and he helped me. And with him and some other help, I got there through the night and the next day. But that was tough because I couldn't. I was ready to drop out. I just couldn't go anymore.
And for our listeners, tell us what that would have meant if you would have dropped out. You would have been left for dead, or maybe
they might shoot me or to make sure I wasn't playing games with them, and so that they didn't. No, they didn't. I'd have frozen. I had my feet were already frozen. I couldn't go anywhere.
You know? So you thought that was it?
Yep, that was as close as I've ever come.
And a desperate prayer was answered, and a big strapping fellow American who.
Right.
And who knows? Who knows who he was, huh?
I don't know. Never saw him. It was in the middle of the night, and I didn't ask him. He saw me stumbling and heading for the edge of the column, and grabbed me and says, "Hang in there." And we, the two of us, stumbled along. You've seen it in the movies, and that's the way it is.
And I've had so many prisoners of war repeat to me the POW motto of "We help those who can't help themselves." And there was someone who helped you when you couldn't help yourself. How many times over the years have you thought back to that when someone needed help from you?
I've been there.
Mm-hmm. And I can tell it's still powerful for you, and I certainly understand why. So you made it through that night.
We wept all that night, and then the next day, and then they finally let us start, give us a rest. Some of us were in a schoolhouse, some of us were in a church, a barn, whatever, because there wasn't any facilities. It was just where you could flop, and we spent that night there. And then the next day, we were in a little town called Gerolstein, Gerolstein, something like that. And they loaded us on boxcars at that time.
And this is the famous 40 and 8, 40 people or 8 horses, but I'm sure they stuck a lot more than 40 in there.
60.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't, you sat down with your knees up, and then the guy got behind you and his back to yours were the same. And if you got into that position, everybody got in that position, you could all sit down at one time, Otherwise, you couldn't.
And you probably needed that for some body heat, too, right?
The heat came from the manure. It was in the boxcar. There was about 8-10 inches of manure in the boxcar. And us city boys didn't know how many BTUs there were on a pound of horse manure. But it was because the next day, a couple guys, when they would let us out to relieve ourselves. And,
sure.
And there was no water, so we'd be eating some snow. And a couple of them asked if they could shovel this stuff out, the manure out. Well, man, when you, that part where the car, where these jokers got rid of the manure, was frozen just like the...
Never thought you'd be wishing for horse manure,
no,
huh?
No.
And this sounds like a miserable existence. I mean, certainly the uncertainty could eat you alive, if not the freezing temperatures and just the agony of really not having any sustenance.
We hadn't eaten. When we got captured, we hadn't eaten for 2 days. They just had to bring the chow up to us because when we were by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Jeep didn't get there for 2 days before we were captured. Mm-hmm. So we still didn't have anything to eat until, well, I guess it would be the second day, they give us a loaf of bread for five guys, one of their brown breads that they make out of
sawdust. Tree flour.
Yeah.
He would spend the next 6 months moving from one prisoner of war camp to another, four of them in total. He even survived an 8-day, 100-mile forced march through the snow.
Well, you just kept going because you had to keep going. What are you going to do, you know, and make the best of it?
Just the will to survive?
Yep. It's there. And you just picked one foot up, put it in front of the other. It was so damn numb and dumb, and you just didn't know. You didn't have time to worry.
At hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to all the full-length original interviews with the Battle of the Bulge survivors you're hearing from today. Because of the heavy casualties suffered, there is a huge need for replacements. And many young Americans experienced their very first taste of combat at the Bulge, including George Hansen of the 11th Armored Division.
We were heading towards the city of Bastogne, and we stopped at night and went to sleep on that ground next to a haystack. And we thought, well, we'll have a good night's rest here by this haystack. And about 10 o'clock, the captain says, we're moving out. So we got in our armored column, tanks in the front, and then half tracks with machine gun squads and other foot soldiers, and we're headed for Bastogne.
And tell us why it was so important to get to Bastogne, because the timing of this was the Battle of the Bulge, right?
That's right, and there were hundreds of soldiers there surrounded by Germans, and our goal was to go and rescue them. So we're on the way up there, and I'm in the back riding along, a couple tanks in front, and then behind us other trucks with more soldiers. And all of a sudden, about 11 o'clock at night, this explosion wakes up the guys like me that were sort of dozing in the back as we went along in this armored column. And it was an explosion. A German shell had come and landed right in the middle of the nine of us in the back. The explosion woke us up if we were asleep. And I immediately felt that my leg on my left side was, I thought it was blown off. So I started feeling to see where it ended. And I got to my foot, and I was very happy that I still had a foot and a leg. But it was numb from the explosion, which ripped off my overcoat that had a hand grenade in it and a camera I carried. And I couldn't feel a thing. But they said, get out of this vehicle fast. So I got out. And, you know, isn't it interesting how God treated me? There was a medic's Jeep right behind our vehicle. The nurses or whoever they were, guys with first aid caps on their head, they took me in this Jeep to a field hospital and then the next day to a hospital where I spent a few weeks in a warm room having meals in bed being treated by American nurses. And I thought, wow, am I ever blessed to be alive and to be here? Well, the rest of my buddies were for 2 days pinned down by the German artillery, sleeping in the snowbanks.
Yeah, you talk about something that could have saved your life, maybe being shaken up and wounded, and you did get the Purple Heart for that incident. Maybe that did save your life. And more about that shell, so we can understand how amazing it is that you did survive as intact as you were. You said it tore your overcoat off, smashed all the contents, and it also put a hole in the floor of this metal half track?
That's right. And sitting right next to me, it was very snug back there with all of us together with our heavy overcoats on and a gun in our hand. The guy next to me was killed immediately. They said it kind of blew up his insides. And the one sitting across from him, whose feet my feet were touching, was also killed immediately. And a couple others were wounded. So when a few weeks later, when I went back to my organization, it was a new bunch of replacements, except for two or three guys of the 12. And the captain says, George, now you are the squad leader. So I took over as the squad leader.
Wow. I know you've lived with that for more than 70 years, but is it a little hard for you to believe that the guy on either side of you, the guy to your right and the guy to your left, they're both killed, that you think you lost your leg, but you didn't, it's intact, and you didn't even bleed?
Well, you know, I said, God, if you get me out alive, I'll do anything. And I began to think, well, he kept me alive through this, and I wonder what's next.
George Hansen would go on to become a pastor and a longtime missionary to Brazil. It's time for our first break, but much more to come as we mark the 75th anniversary of the start of the Battle of the Bulge. When we come back, how a medic escaped from the same SS troops who carried out the Malmedy Massacre. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 75 years ago this week, the Ardennes counteroffensive began in Europe, triggering what we would come to remember as the Battle of the Bulge. On the second day of that battle, German forces led by Joachim Peiper executed 84 Americans they had captured at a crossroads near Malmedy, Belgium, in an incident that would become known as the Malmedy Massacre. A young medic named E.J. Leatherman wouldn't realize until later how close he came to suffering that same fate.
On the 15th of December, they came through and they said, take everything that you can carry with you that's important. Anything else, we're going to burn it or bury it or give it to the people around here. So that's what we did. And next morning, we took off in a column of all the half tracks and all our personnel. We had 1,500 men in our battalion. As we were going down this road, I heard this sound above my head behind me, and it sounded like a 6x6 truck up there in the sky. I looked back, and here's this German pilot. I can see him just as plain. He's a little young guy. He looked like probably about 20 years old, and he had this fighter pilot. So he cut loose with a burst of ammo, and it came along our left side on the dirt, and then he cut across. He's swinging back and forth because he was afraid we were going to get our machine gun set up and knock him out of the sky. But he got away before we could dismount and get all of our machine guns set up for him. But that introduced us to the Battle of Bulge. That's the first arms that started us on that trek into Malmedy. They said when we get to Malmedy, that'll be the start of the Bulge. And that was true. When we got there, they placed us in a field. And we, the medics in our group, we stayed at a dairy. The guy owned four cows and had a few of the big milking cans. We used those cans as urinals up in the second floor. And the men, it was all snow and cold. And I stayed in my half track. I made my bedroll with three big blankets, and I curled them back and forth three times. So I had about nine layers of blankets in me, and I laid on the floor in my half track on that iron, and that's where I slept and lived. We were there for several days, and well, about six airplanes came over us, and they were American planes, and these planes were bombers. So we were standing out in the snow waving at them, and all of a sudden they dropped the bombs. The snow was flying. They went in and hit Malmedy, downtown, all over the building there, killed a lot of people. The fact was that the German head honkers had put in a call on the radios that they had captured Malmedy and that they had waiting for the Americans to show up. So our military then sent the aircrafts in, thinking they were going to bomb the Germans there in Malmedy. Inadvertently, they hit some of our people and a lot of the civilians. So that was my occasion of being there. We got orders one day that our B company over in Stavelo was being butchered, and they had a lot of wounded and killed and needed the medics over there to take care of them. So the colonel and I were good friends because he loved baseball, and he always won money when we'd win ball games. But he asked me, he said, would you take some men and get over there and see what you can do for those people? And I said, well, I don't know how to get there. He said, well, just follow the road there. They'll give you a map. We took off on this. We had two ambulances with half tracks, and we had six of us medics. And as we were going along, we were about 6 kilometers out of Malmedy when I noticed a big rig, like something you'd see in a motor pool working on tanks and things like that. But I'd never seen one like this. But in the bottom, in the back, there was a transmission, oil leaking out of it, and there was a fire coming out. So here it is, foggy, can't hardly see anything, and I'm looking at something, big vehicle that's burning. How's it burning in this ice and snow, cold and fog? And just about then, Nelson said, Leatherman, did you see that? And I said, what's that? He said, a command car just went by us with a big swastika on it. I said, hold it, turn it, get this thing off the road, get it over here on the side. Behind us, Brown, who lived in Tulare, he was driving that half track. He pulled over behind us. So just that time, the command car backed up. There was no place they could turn around. It was too narrow and it was too icy. So they backed up and they stopped right across from where we were. They started hollering in German. The guy said, what's he talking about, Leatherman? I said, well, they want us to get out of the half tracks, put our hands over our heads. They want to search us.
You understood German because your parents and grandparents had spoken German all throughout your childhood, right?
That's correct. I didn't know I knew that much German, but it came to me quite rapidly. I had read up in the little book that they give you in the military how to speak French, how to speak German. So during the months we traveled, I did practice my French and my German. The fellas got out and stood there, and the driver, he had a machine gun, and the man, the officers up on this command car had a higher bench built. It was about 3 or 4 feet higher than normal command car. He looked like Hitler, twice as more powerful than Hitler, with this big fancy rig of his. I stayed in my half track and watched this. They lined him up, and the driver searching, and he came to Walters, and he found a Luger pistol in his jacket. Well, the Lugers were for the German officers. So this driver took the pistol out of his pocket and hit him in the head and knocked him down on the ice. He started hollering at the officer, the German officer, and they were going back and forth pretty rapidly, and I thought, oh, my God, they're going to kill Walters because you're not allowed as a medic to have arms on you. I kind of sweat that out for a moment. Then I heard the colonel say something to the driver that sounded like artillery. When I saw that they weren't going to kill Walters, I got out of the half track and I started hollering, attention in German. And so they looked at me and they hollered at me, come over here. So I went out in the middle of the road and they said, what are you guys doing here? And I said, we're on our way to Stavelo. I was speaking German as well as I could. They said, why are you going to Stavelo? What's your name of your outfit? How many men do you got? So I told them, we have 1,500 men. We did have 1,500 men, but I told them 2,500. And I said, we have about 50 tanks. We're in Malmedy, and we're coming this way. I think you guys ought to get out of here if you don't want to get shot. And they said, what are you going to do in Stavelo? And I said, we have to take care of the wounded there. And we take care of the wounded, and I threw in the fact that we also took care of the enemy. Even though they were the enemy, if they were wounded, we took care of them, hoping that this would persuade them to just leave us alone so that we could get out of there. Oh, they started speaking in Blattdeutsch, which is a slang German. Well, on my mother's side, they spoke a lot of Blattdeutsch, so I knew that as well as I did High German. Anyway, I figured out what they were saying is that they would take care of us with the artillery. Don't worry about it. Just leave them alone. The big commander said, you keep your men right here for 15 minutes. If you move before then, we will fire on you with our artillery. And I said, okay, we will stay 15 minutes. So they took off and went down the road as fast as they could. I said, let's get out of here. So we jumped in our half tracks. We started going as fast as we could. We went about, I'd say, a half a mile, not even a quarter of a mile. And here came an artillery shell. Landed on my side of the road. The snow flew up in the air. The next fire hit on the left side of the road, just missing our half track. As we traveled on, going back to Malmedy, and we came to 8 GIs out in the middle of the road. They were waving. We couldn't get by them, so we stopped. They said, what the hell are they doing shooting at the medics? Who is firing on the medics? And they said, let's get out of here. So they started running back towards Malmedy. So we traveled another about a quarter of a mile, came to another little bend in the road, and there was a lieutenant there with about 24 men. He said, what happened back there? What's all that shooting about? Were they firing at you guys? And we said, yeah, but we didn't want to say anything. We told the other group up ahead, and they started running. He says, my group don't run. He said, what happened? So I told him, and he said, holy cow. He said, where are you headed? And I said, we're going back to Malmedy to find out where we're supposed to go, because we're not going that through that road. So we went back to Malmedy, and the colonel and the outfit saw us coming back, so they sent a runner over to where we were in our bivouac area and said, Colonel Irwin wants to see you, Leatherman. So I went over there, and he said, what happened? So I told him what happened. Oh, incidentally, when we backed up our half-track to turn around by that big rig that was burning, I kept my eyes, my door open. I was keeping Nelson from getting us stuck in that mud, and I was afraid we might not be able to get out of there. And as we drove back, I saw where we had driven over the leg of a soldier. He was buried underneath that ice and snow by that big rig. So when I told Colonel Irwin about it, well, he said, you did a good job, Leatherman. He said, you saved your two ambulances and you saved five medics. And he said, we need those ambulances to figure out how to get them over to Stavelo. So he congratulated me, and I went back to my quarters. I was there about a half an hour, and they came and said, Colonel wants to see you again. I said, okay. So I went over. He said, we just had a man come in here that saw you guys get captured, and he was up in the hills. They killed 100 GIs yesterday, and he was one of them they shot, and they killed at least 7 medics in the bunch. When they got through shooting these people, they walked around and kicked them, and if they made any sound, they shot him in the head. So he saw him coming while he was lying there, and he gritted himself as hard as he could, and the guy saw all the blood on his shoulder and just stepped over. He didn't want to get it on his shoe, I guess. He said, he's dead. So they went to the next guy and shot him. So after the Germans took off, he crawled out of that pasture, went up the side of the hill, took leaves and limbs off of trees, put them on top of him, so he lived through the night, and he saw us captured. Saw the whole thing go on, but he was afraid to holler to us because they'd get him again.
Wow. And if people have never heard of the Malmedy massacre before, they are just getting a picture that you stumbled upon the aftermath of it. And that leg that as you drove off, you saw under the snow was one of the victims of that horrible German atrocity there, where Americans were just mowed down after they had surrendered. And so now, when you hear this and you find out that just the day before you were there, all these Americans were killed in cold blood by German forces, probably the same Germans who had you captured. When you realize that, what did that do to you?
Well, it was a very scary moment because they undoubtedly would have shot us. But the fact was, when I got out of my half track, I left my door open, thinking that it might impress them that maybe we had some wounded soldiers in our ambulance. When you're wounded, you still keep your arms. So they didn't know but what we have somebody in there with arms that would be able to shoot them. So they were in a position where they had to get away as well as we had to get away. And the fact that this kid, they told us later on, it was 100. They boiled it down to 80. I think the last time I heard it was 87 was the true count of those that was killed, but there was 7 or 8 who did like the other guy that came there and or happened to see us captured. 7 or 8 other people did the same thing in the other hills. A few people lived, but most of them were slaughtered out there in that pasture. And it was very scary to me to think that these are the guys that captured us. Why didn't they shoot us? Well, they didn't shoot us because they were sitting ducks. For anybody in my half track that had an M1 rifle, could have shot him. So that's why I left the door open to start with. And it worked out real well for us.
But it might not have worked out if you would have followed their orders and stayed for 15 minutes. And I want to read something here and then come back with a few follow-up questions for you. This was from the British government. It says, on 18th December 1944, Corporal Leatherman, operating a medical half track near Stavelot, Belgium, got behind the German lines and was stopped, searched, and made to leave his vehicle. He deceived the German officer as to our strength, went back to his vehicle, and drove it off under close scrutiny from the Germans and other personnel. His courage and resourcefulness not only saved his vehicle and possibly the lives of his fellow soldiers, but kept the ambulance to evacuate wounded men badly in need of attention. So this is an addition to your Bronze Star from the U.S. military, to the Croix de Guerre from the French. The British government gave you this medal, and it was actually presented to you not long after that by a name that I think people would recognize. Who was it that pinned that medal on you?
That was the general of the British Army, Montgomery. He came through Wiesbaden, Germany. After the war was over, he came through and decorated me and Major Solis with the medal from the British government, which was a very big honor for me. And then the French Army gave me the French Croix de Guerre with the Ecole de Bronze. That means with the Bronze Star. That means you have two medals of that. And then the Bronze Stars, I had one for that occasion of the capture, and I had another one for another episode, and then I was given another Bronze Star for the fact that when the war was over, they gave all the riflemen in the American Army who fought in the war, they gave them Bronze Stars. So the military soldiers said, what about the medics? And they said, well, if we deserve them, the medics deserve the Bronze Stars also. So they did give all the medics who were in combat the Bronze Star. So that's why I have 3 Bronze Stars.
In this occasion in particular, 18th of December of 44, to have the armies of 3 different countries recognize that what you did was significant and worth noting, that's pretty special. But I'm curious how much you've thought about it since then. And if I say, well, if you had agreed to stay for 15 minutes, like the Germans asked you to do, do you think you would be here talking to me today?
No, there's no doubt about it that they had their artillery set up for that. It's called Cross Points, is the actual place of the slaughter of Malmedy. They had it zeroed in. That's how they came so close, because they couldn't see us. It was too much fog, but they came very close to us. So they would have got us for sure if circumstances weren't what they were under that occasion. We were very fortunate. We knew it as soon as we brought in that prisoner from off that hill. We knew that we were just very fortunate. And I thank my Heavenly Father for saving my life. I've been saved at least 12 times in my lifetime. And so there has to be somebody else that's helping you on these occasions. And for me to speak the German that I spoke that day was a revelation to me. It's a good thing to learn another language, but I never thought that the German language would ever benefit me to that degree.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're saying that in the heat of the moment, you were able to communicate in a way that you probably didn't think you could. You didn't think you knew German that well to be able to do that. But in that moment, as the adrenaline's pumping, as everything's going on, it sounds like the words just came to you.
That's true. That's a remarkable part about a brain. It can retain things that you don't even know you have. You asked me if I ever think about this, and that's the one occasion that capture is the one thing that comes to light very often in the middle of the night, and I think, well, what should I have done? What could I have done? How come I did it that way? And the one thing I thought of, I think of more often than anything, is if they would have shot Walters, I would have fired up my half track, and I'd charge straight across the road because they could not turn around, and I'd have crashed into that command car. I could have crushed them back into that snowbank, and maybe we could have come out without losing anybody either. It's just things like that, but I get upset because I can't sleep. What good does it do to worry about these things now? But that, I'm sure all the other people in combat have the same experiences. It bugs you that you can't get it out of your head sometimes. But all in all, I'm thankful for all the things that I've done and been a part of, and especially with personnel I was around. We had a great bunch of military people and officers, and so that's why we came out of this thing as well as we did.
That was the late E.J. Leatherman, a baseball star before the war, a chiropractor later, and another Battle of the Bulge survivor with a story to tell. When we come back, another resilient Purple Heart recipient whose life and face were never the same after the Bulge. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our focus today on the Battle of the Bulge, which began 75 years ago this week on that frozen European continent. Another perspective on the Bulge now from Dick Reiber, who served with the 82nd Airborne Division.
Christmas Day, we had the ground around there was frozen about 6 inches, four to six inches deep.
Yeah.
At that time, I had been transferred to carry ammunition for a 60mm mortar.
All right.
And it came in big cardboard tubes with a tape around it.
Right.
Well, you should have been able to grab a hold of the tape, and if you got it right, you could zip it off and take the tube apart.
Okay.
Some of the boys didn't seem to grasp the exact mechanics, or the tape was old.
Or frozen.
Or both. All three.
Yeah.
And they were just dumping those to one side because they couldn't get the cap off. I said, here, let me take care of that. And I got out my little pocket knife with a little short stubby blade that I use for that cutting things. Mm-hmm. And I'd zip on down through that tape and grab the end of it on the point of the blade and rip it off and had the ammunition ready. We heard this Jerry machine gunner up there, and we could hear the bullets going overhead. And the lead gunner for that mortar says, hold it a minute, I'm going to re-aim this. Entirely by sight or sound, I don't think he could see anything, but entirely by sound, I believe, he reset the aiming of it. You know, they lean it back and forth to
right.
aim it.
Yeah.
And then they take, on the tail end of it, there's charges, different charges. And they can take and leave most of them if they want the project to go a long way.
Right.
or they take most of them off if they just want to get it just barely in front of their people out in front of them. He reset the mortar, reset the charge on a shell. He dropped two shells down the barrel of that thing. You take it and drop it down. When it hits the bottom, it's like a shotgun shell in the bottom.
Right.
It hits a firing pin and it goes off. And he dropped two, waited a couple minutes. We never heard any more from that gunner.
Mm-hmm. So even blind to where that position
was. That guy was a miracle. I mean, he was just had a touch for it.
That is impressive.
And I never did learn his name.
So that there's another situation where if he doesn't miraculously pull that off, you guys might have been sitting ducks for that German machine gun?
Yes.
You mentioned how frozen the ground was. Had you ever dealt with cold like what you encountered there?
Not really. I had dealt with some cold up in South Dakota.
Right.
It gets cold up there.
But I bet you had better sleeping arrangements in South Dakota than at the Battle of the Bulge.
Quite a bit better.
Where'd you have to sleep at the Bulge?
In my foxhole.
How'd you dig a foxhole?
You went out and dug it for yourself.
Even through the ice?
It so happened that the few times I did dig a foxhole, we were back in the woods a little bit, back in brush, mm-hmm. and the ground doesn't freeze as hard back there.
All right.
And in fact, it was a few days later, we'd taken a good march for quite a few hours at night, and we'd gotten into this other area and dug in. And about that time, I saw this happen. And one of our armored groups came through this little town over there, following the road. They couldn't make any progress if they got off the road because of the ground being frozen partway and just enough so that they'd sink in and couldn't get out of it.
The tanks would get stuck.
They'd get stuck.
All right.
They got out just out by the edge of town, and a jury gunner, somebody over there, spotted them. He zeroed in. He'd already zeroed in on that area. Mm-hmm. So he knew just how to shoot his gun. And he knocked out the lead vehicle. Then he knocked out the last one that he could see in that line. And then he could pick the rest of them off to suit himself. That was Hogan's Task Force 400. I don't think I'll ever forget that.
So you...
I saw that.
You were watching this, and it's just devastation. It's just sitting ducks.
Well, not like I would be a field around here, away from it. We were in the edge of a grove of small trees.
So just, we're talking 100, 200 yards, something like that.
It might have been a quarter of a mile.
Quarter of a mile.
Yeah.
But you're watching this, and there's nothing you can do about it.
No.
And Americans are getting killed left and right.
And we couldn't tell where the gunner was that was doing the shooting at them.
Mm-hmm.
But those 88s that they had were really a nasty piece of artillery.
How did you handle that? What did that do to you to see that?
I wasn't really getting a close-up, so it didn't penetrate quite as much as if I'd been closer. But just seeing those vehicles get shot, I couldn't tell whether there were people in them. By the time the first one got hit, they would have evacuated the vehicles. They'd gotten out of them because they knew they couldn't get away. And I never did hear how they did make out as a group, except that they had gotten pretty well shot up.
That can't make you feel too encouraged about your own future or prospects of getting out of there alive.
Well, funny thing, but I guess I just didn't have the emotional setup right that I would worry about it so much.
Maybe that's a good thing.
It either happened or it wouldn't happen. As I said, the next night we got to move to a different area, going out of a little village there. In fact, that's where I saw my first Volkswagen.
Oh, yeah?
In that little village. And there was a hill there. We climbed that hill. I was carrying machine gun ammunition for a 30 caliber light machine gun and then.
All right.
And I got down in the snow and didn't get far enough down in the snow. I don't know whether if I'd have had my face clear down in it, whether or not I'd been that shell fragment would have missed me completely or not. I don't think so.
Before we get more into that, let me take you back to Christmas Day. And I know you just said you didn't have the emotional makeup to think, oh, I might not make it and worry about all that. But on Christmas Day, when you're out there freezing your rear end off and the enemy's shooting at you, I imagine there had to be a moment where you thought, boy, it'd be nice to be back home in the States with my wife.
Yes.
And something tells me there's probably been a Christmas or two in the 70 years since that you've thought back to that Christmas.
There's been a few.
What do you think of when you think back to that Christmas?
I think that my life has been watched over.
Did you feel it then? When you were out there in combat, did you feel that God was looking out for you?
I felt that it probably. It was beyond my worry, beyond my capability to do anything about personally at that moment. And for some reason or another, that worry just didn't get hold of me, and it didn't.
So now we're into January. It hasn't gotten any warmer. There's still snow everywhere and ice. And you're sleeping out in it. And on the 4th of January, as you said, you're carrying this machine gun ammunition.
Boxes, metal boxes with a belt of machine gun ammunition.
And had you guys been under fire before you got hit, or you didn't know this was coming?
We had moved several times. We went through this little village. They had us lined up along down below it, and then we were supposed to go up there because they thought somebody was up there to shoot at, I guess. The one I was near, they all spread out. I mean, we weren't one every 50 feet around there.
Uh-huh.
And my machine gunner was up ahead of me, and I figured, well, in spite of that few Jerry shells going overhead, I saw two of them.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of that, if he didn't move out of there pretty quick, it'd be because he couldn't, and it'd be my turn to go play with the gun. Only thing was that Jerry was firing every 30 seconds, and the next one had my address on it. So here I was up on top of this hill.
Right.
A lot of bush over that to that side of me, valley down in front of me, and more open land in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I... That was a pretty bad hit afterward.
So you went to get down. You got to his position where his machine gun was.
No, I never saw him.
You were heading his way.
I was backing him up, waiting to see if he to get him some more ammunition.
Right.
He was supposed to call another box of ammunition.
Because if you took too long, that may cost him his life. If there's too long of a pause between his firing, he becomes more vulnerable.
He does.
So you're waiting to get him this ammunition. They start shooting at you. You tried to get down?
What they were doing, there was no small arms fire there. They were throwing shells over,
88s.
Artillery shells over.
Uh-huh.
And they were going way over us.
Right.
Where I was. Unfortunately, they dropped one a lot closer.
So they're making the adjustment, and this 88 shell comes right in your area.
They can drop those right in front of the gun itself if they want to. I was down on my knees and squatting way down.
But a shell hits, and pieces of it.
Apparently hit just close to me, too, because the angle that this scar was through is through my arm, and the angle that this hit me.
So it hits your right shoulder and the right side of your face.
It hit my arm right in here.
Yep, your bicep, your right bicep. And tricep, and the right side of your face.
And the right side of my face.
What did that feel like?
Wasn't much feeling to it. It was just a big thunder. Boom.
I mean, did it
big
feel
noise.
Like... Felt like Joe Louis slugging you in the face or something?
Well, I didn't really have any much feeling there. I didn't really have much feeling till later, till after it had...
Did it stun you? Did it knock you out?
I don't think it did, but I was only one round there for 75 or 100 feet, so I don't have any idea of what else was.
So it hits you, and I'm sure at some point you realize how bad it is.
Well, after I spit that chunk of a jawbone out, yes, I did.
So explain to us what it did to your jaw.
Actually, it took out a piece of the upper maxillary bone on the right side and opened a hole. I didn't know at the time, but later I found out it opened a hole into the right maxillary sinus. Then I also got a couple of holes through my upper arm here, which were not really serious.
And another piece of it, maybe an inch long, settled in the left side of your jaw.
No, it went in here.
On the right side.
And stopped here.
And stopped in your left jaw. Yep.
And it did crack the roof of my mouth. It separated the two bones that form the roof of your mouth there.
That sounds like a bloody mess.
Yeah.
Were you scared?
Maybe I did. I don't really recall the fear as such.
Did you think you're about to die?
I knew there was a good chance that I wouldn't find an aid man back there if I didn't get moving, but I could still walk. And I wondered a time or two how much worse that I would might have been injured if I hadn't been dressed for cold weather. I had on an undershirt, a knit undershirt. Winter, a wool shirt, a sweater, a combat jacket, which is similar to what they use it nowadays as a combat jacket, and a wool overcoat. And that went through all of that to hit me there.
Yeah. Well, and even with your face. I mean, if it's an inch up, your eyes are gone, or your nose is gone, or both, right?
I was just, I don't know. I couldn't really say that it was, I felt a shivery fear.
Right. Oh, I'm just thinking now. I mean, how fortunate, not that I want to make light of anything you've gone through for 70 years, but how much worse it could have been. Or if you hadn't gotten down at all, maybe it takes out your midsection and you die there. But as it stands, your face is blown open. You've got a wound in your upper arm, and you're leaving a trail of blood in the snow because you can walk trying to find an aid man.
I found one. Got back there, and I think he gave me some kind of a anesthetic shot.
Morphine or something?
I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
And next thing I remember is riding a stretcher that was anchored on the back of a Jeep.
At some point, they had to wire your jaw shut?
They did. The funny thing was they put those rubber bands on there. 2 months later, after I got back to the hospital in England, somebody gave me a pair of little scissors to hang on a cord around my neck to cut that in case I got nauseated.
How many years were you recuperating in hospitals overseas and back home?
Well, I was injured in January of 45. It was in March, I believe. I finally went to work there in L.A.
March of what year?
47.
So more than 2 years.
They'd do a little adjustment, tissue rearrangement, get it started healing, and then send me home for a while.
What's been the hardest thing to deal with, the most challenging impact on your life from that shell?
That's a hard one to answer. Sometimes it was just a case of putting one foot in front of the other, keeping going.
I'm sure there were days where that was hard. Or maybe you didn't want to.
There have been days when I didn't want to get up. Yes.
What gave you hope when your face is blown half to bits and you don't know if it's ever going to be better? Where do you find that hope to keep going?
That's almost an unanswerable question.
Yeah?
I can't pin it down.
It's just there somewhere inside you?
I don't really know. I have thought about a few things like that when I didn't get to sleep in the hurry at night. But tomorrow is out there waiting to happen.
And it might just be better than today.
Keep going. Find out what it is. Not necessarily that I think it's going to be any better or any worse. It will probably be a little different.
But it's worth finding out.
Pretty much.
All right. Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it because, you know, a lot of us can't understand the price that's been paid for our freedom unless we hear from someone like you.
Well, if you want a statement of fact, I consider that what little bit I actually contributed to the war wasn't enough to brag about.
That puts you in real good company.
I kept going, but it wasn't I didn't wipe out an enemy regiment or even an enemy foxhole, far as I knew, but I kept going.
Hundreds of thousands of Americans kept going in the Battle of the Bulge. Millions of Americans kept going throughout World War II. And my hope as we bring today's episode to a close is that whatever you're facing in life, whatever you have to endure, I hope the stories of these four Battle of the Bulge survivors today will encourage you to keep going as well. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.